Well, I went to work for him the week after I graduated from high school in 1967 and got my first taste of being a professional musician and everything. And after about a month, I found out that those white castles really weren't houses I was going to live in. They were the burger joints that I could afford to eat at, you know. So I bailed on that whole thing and came back up here and went to school for a couple of years and got drafted after that, wound up going in the military. But I went back to Nashville in the early 70s and wound up just getting real lucky when I got there. Within a year, I'd started hanging in with a group of folks down around the Pickin' Parlor on 2nd Avenue where Randy Wood and Tut Taylor had a shop set up down there. And I wound up picking up all these jobs from there. I wound up doing master scale sessions for folks like Leon Russell and going to Las Vegas and playing as part of the Harry James Phil Harris show and just all kinds of other real oddball stuff like that. Tex Logan came in to Tut's shop one day and told me that Wilmerlee and Stoney needed a banjo player. So I wound up working with them until Stoney passed away. And then it wasn't long after that that Stoney was the greatest man I ever worked for in my life. I mean, I've never worked for anybody who was so appreciative of his sidemen in my life as Stoney was. They paid higher than other acts of that day, and they didn't make all that much money. And every time we would come off stage, be it good, bad, or indifferent, Stoney would always come over, shake your hand, thank you for the wonderful job you had done for him. And he was just a wonderful human being to work for. So anyhow, when that sort of fizzled out on me working around that, Bill Holden called me up and told me he was quitting Bill Monroe at that point and asked me if I wanted the job. And I said, man, I don't know. I've been there one time and it didn't work out too well then. So I was over at the Opry one night before Bill had quit, and Bill Monroe came up to me and asked me if I would like to go to work playing the banjo for him. And I said, well, Mr. Bill, we done tried that about 10 years ago, and it didn't work out too well. He said, yeah, but we've both grown a lot since then. So I wound up taking that job and working for him for about 4 years at that point. It was I went in Labor Day of 77, and I worked through the 4th of July weekend of 81 on that. And I left him to start my own group. I started a group called the Bluegrass Band that had Alan O'Brien, Ed Dye, David Sebring, and Blaine Sprouse in it. And when I quit that band, Alan swapped over from playing guitar, which he had done for me, and started playing the banjo, hired Pat Enright, and they became the Nashville Bluegrass Band then. And that's one of the bands Mike Compton ultimately went to work for right there. But I had quit Monroe under probably one of the awfulest meltdowns I ever had in life. It wasn't a very good situation and circumstance there for me. And then to bring it on up toward the end of what was going on, I had made a couple of recording packages from a fellow over in Blacksburg named Kerry Hay. And he wanted a little label in his retirement. He started up called Hey Holler, and I did these things for him that he could put on TV and sell, and they actually had pretty good sales for him. They enabled him to have that record label. And he wanted me to cut, the first one I did was called Once Again from the Top. Not long after that, he wanted me to cut a gospel version of the thing. And I had sort of changed my life around. I'd become baptized in a church at that point and everything. And I got to thinking about it, and I just said, I can't make that record until I've made my peace with Monroe. And I went down to McClure, to Ralph Stanley's festival down there. And Blake Williams, bless his heart, held my hand all day in my nervousness, you know, till I could finally find a time that Monroe wasn't busy. And I went up to him, and you know, when he was walking out of the door backstage, and I was standing in the door so he couldn't get around me, and he looked up and he saw who it was, and it was just like he had seen a ghost, and he said, Well, what do you want? And I said, well, Mr. Bill, I think when I quit, it was one of the awfulest things that I ever did in my life. And I said, I've come here to apologize to you, try to apologize to you, and beg for your forgiveness. And he looked me right in the face and he said, oh, well, it's about time. And it was just one of the biggest weight came off of my shoulders. So I came back and made the gospel record. And Carrie enabled me later on to make a Butch Robbins record. That's the way I did all my banjo records back then. You know, when I was doing band sound things, it was under the bluegrass band. But when I would do banjo records, they would be Butch Robbins records. So I get to Nashville and had a couple of fellas that didn't show up for the first sessions. David Greer and Mike Compton were there, but a couple of other guys didn't show. So I went out to Mr. Monroe's house the next day and I said, Mr. Bill, I've had a couple of people lay down on me. I said, would you consider coming to the studio and helping me out with this recording today? And he looked around and, you know, found out that he didn't have anything to do that afternoon. And he said, well, he might be there that afternoon. Well, I showed up at the studio an hour early and he was already in the parking lot. Wow. So I wound up getting him on that recording. I wound up with 2 days. And Mike Compton was the most selfless, wonderful human being in that. I had he and Monroe sitting right in front of each other. And Monroe, at that point, he was good for a couple of hours, and then he would start to lapse. His attention span would drop on stuff. So Mike sat right in front of him and played the tunes to him while he was playing them so he wouldn't lose his place in what they were.
Well, that is an amazing thing. I've always heard this little quip you're talking about, the early days when it's time to pay the band. Bill would say, anybody got change for a 20?
That was, I mean, you know, you got to realize, and when I went to work for him in 67 too, you know, times were hard for those guys then. The bluegrass festivals hadn't caught on. You know, there were only a few of them. Bill started Bean Blossom that year. I played the first Bean Blossom with him. And those guys were coming off a stretch from like 1957 up until that mid-60s there. It was, I mean, Monroe worked that first Fincastle Festival up here and paid the band. His contract said $250 on it. So, you know, there and it was minimal pay then, and I think that's about how many people showed up for the weekend up there that first thing. So it wasn't something where you could expect a whole lot of money out of it, that's for sure.
I don't want to keep you here a long time, but I love hearing you talk about this. If you could just tell us a little bit about your perception and how you feel that bluegrass with Bill Monroe, how it was viewed when it first started out. He was a member of the Grand Ole Opry, but he was, wasn't really accepted with the type of music he was playing.
Well, it not only had to do with the guys like Sam and Kurt McGee and folks down there, you know, they had all said he played too fast. He played in keys that other people couldn't play in. He sang in ranges that other people couldn't sing in. And so there was a little bit of professional jealousy there and happening. But Bill's personality didn't do him any favors. It's like I heard him tell the story of one of the first gospel songs that he had done on the Grand Ole Opry. You know, when an entertainer would be up to center mic and doing his thing, there was all kinds of other activity happening on that stage. You know, you used to hear some lady get up and sing a sad song, and you'd hear Oswald over in the corner like he was crying out, you know, the loneliness and all that stuff. And there was, like I said, there was commotion on stage. Well, Monroe had done this gospel song, and somebody had been raising a ruckus back there. So he walks back and gets whoever it was that was causing the ruckus by their lapels and lifted them up on the side of a wall and allowed, if anybody ever makes a sound on this stage when I'm doing a gospel song, I'll mop the stage up with them. Now, that's not the way you endear yourself to your fellow cast members, is by threatening them and everything. He had a dark, brooding personality, and you know, he was quite a healthy man back in those days and everything. Nobody really wanted to fool with him. So the whole term of applying bluegrass to his music is basically the way the announcers were saying, he's not one of us.
saying he's playing that Kentucky bluegrass music.
Yeah, they're playing that bluegrass music from up in Kentucky. You know, where most of the rest of the cast there, Acuff and all the rest of the guys there, were Middle Tennessee, you know, Tennessee folks and everything. That was sort of a separator that came along for all that, to separate him from country music.
And then along comes all these folks basically breathing life into the genre and the festival starting and everything. It just had a rebirth.
Well, it happened for him when Ralph Renzler discovered him. Ralph Renzler went to Nashville in the late 50s or very early 60s down there and basically took over as Bill's manager. He renegotiated his contract with Decca. There were two records that came out then, an instrumental album and another album called High Lonesome Sound. They were the first two records ever put out that had a listing on the back of the songs, the individual sidemen who played on the songs and where they had been recorded. That was something that Ralph added to the thing, you know, when he, like I said, renegotiated Bill's contract with Decca. He also clarified a lot of his business out there because, you know, I saw James Buchanan, Bill's father's ledgers from the coal mine and the sawmills and everything that he had on his property up there. And the old man kept immaculate ledgers, down to a quarter of a penny, I think, that they used to call them mites. With Bill, he didn't have any of that kind of sensibility about his money or anything. Bill Keith told me a story that Earl had told him during the writing of the Earl Scruggs instruction book when all that was going down, that Bill had gotten Earl Scruggs to go get him a bank account because he used to just carry his money around in grocery bags. So Earl goes down, sets up this bank account for Bill, comes back and gives him his checkbook and gives him his passbook for his savings, had a checking account and a savings account set up, told Bill, showed him how to write a check and everything. And Bill comes back to Earl in a couple of weeks and hands him a couple of grocery bags and says, go down to the bank and get me some money. I'm out of money, you know. You know, so he and Charlie and Birch, now I don't know about John and Speed, the two older boys, because all I know of them is there's a fellow named Danny Jones who Sam Bush replaced in the Bluegrass Alliance when he came to work there. Danny had gone to work for John and Speed and Birch in the sawmill. They had three sawmills on the property up there in what they called a pony mine on the Monroe homestead up there near Rosine. And, you know, they had a classical mandolin player that worked for them up there too by the name of Hubert Stringfield. And I'm convinced that's where a lot of Monroe's technique came from. Like, if you watch his right hand when he's playing a tremolo, it's all from the wrist. He doesn't go, you know, like Sam Bush plays from his elbow when he's playing. With Monroe, it was all from his wrist, and he could lay the heel of his hand on his bridge to mute the sound a little bit and come up with a deeper, darker sound coming out of that mandolin. Well, that's a pure classical technique. It's like a golfer's left hand keeping that wrist to where it doesn't break, the back of the hand doesn't break the plane with the forearm there. You know, a lot of people turn their hands over and get it to, you know, the weight of the hand, let that do something. With Monroe, that's a technique that was there. A lot about his singing, I saw him do a singing workshop one time in Olympia, Washington, and he was talking about how he breathes from his diaphragm. I go back home, or to Nashville, and I was talking to Kathy Chiavola about it. She's got a master's degree in classical opera from Oberlin College and used to teach, you know, voice lessons there in Nashville and everything. And she said Monroe's techniques for singing were techniques that a classical singer would use, you know. And I'm sort of convinced that a lot of that came from that fellow Hubert Stringfield, who worked for Bill's dad on the farm when Bill determined he was going to pick up a mandolin and play it. And I end my rambling now, Luke. I don't know where I am, so you'll have to get me back on track here.
I'm just enthralled. But we're talking about how you know the bluegrass developed the genre of bluegrass music, and how it developed early on with Bill, and then what happened with the rebirth of it and where it stands today.
Yeah. In that rebirth, what I was meaning to say was after Ralph Renzler got his business organized for him, Carlton came along, Carlton Haney up here, and started these bluegrass festivals at Fincastle. He had two up here before he moved it to Berryville for the Labor Day show, and then he wound up moving the Labor Day show to Reidsville and putting the Berryville Festival on it another day when he started expanding out from that. But not only that, see, what had happened in the late 50s as well, Bill had been knocked off his high horse as the musician around the Grand Ole Opry, because all of a sudden Ernest Tubb and Ray Price were in there, and they had these wonderful bands, you know, that they had hired out of Bob Wills' Texas Playboys and everything. And Monroe didn't have that place where he was musically superior to those guys so much. But then all of a sudden he gets a banjo player to come down to him by the name of William Bradford Keith, and Farron Young heard him back in a dressing room playing Sailor's Hornpipe. So one night when Bill had finished his last song on the Opry, Farron Young said, you know, we've been hearing this banjo player play, why don't you get him to play one? And Bill Keith played Sailor's Hornpipe on the Grand Ole Opry, and it had much the same reaction that Earl had had back in 1945 when he first came there. And that got Bill's head spinning, because here's a melodic banjo player that come along and play. So Bill started working his way back into fiddle tunes. Then he gets, not too long after that, Richard Green comes into the band, who Stephan Grappelli said was the greatest jazz violinist the North American continent ever produced. Peter Rowan was in the band at that time. A wonderful banjo player from up in the D.C. area by the name of Lamar Greer, who was like Rudy Lyle on psychedelics. I mean, he played some of the bluesiest things, like in Blue Night, the tune Crossing the Cumberlands that came up. And the more that they came out with these intricacies of these fiddle tunes and everything, where, you know, the scope of the music sort of narrowed, because all of a sudden the banjo was playing what the fiddle was playing, what the mandolin was playing. The scope sort of narrowed in the thing. But by the same token, it got extremely complex there. And so it put Monroe back up on that high horse. He was like a jazz version of country music at that point. And that elevated art form that he was sort of epitomized itself with the tunes like that Jerusalem Ridge we did. But the album that I cut with him, Master of Bluegrass, that had Old Dangerfield, Old Ebenezer, My Last Days on Earth, Come Hither to Go Yonder. I mean, there's some of those pieces of music right there that are fairly difficult to play. And, I mean, he just performed well. And even to the point that the recording I gave you that he helped me out with in 94, about a year before he passed away. I mean, he was still writing. We've got one tune in there on that record that he had written the week before. And he come in and he sat down and played it for David, Mike, and myself. And, you know, here's a good little tune I've been working on right here for you, you know. So that, you know, that's one thing that I'd always hear. I remember one night I'd been at a jam session down in a house in Madison, Tennessee, and I looked across the room from me, and there sat Earl Scruggs, Curly Seckler, and Benny Martin. I mean, part of that original band. And I played with those guys. Vassar was there that night. John Hartford was there that night. And just wonderful playing and everything. And it was great to, you know, to be around those guys, you know, and hear them tell the old stories like what I'm telling you now. And the next morning, I called Mr. Bill up, and I said, Mr. Bill, you got a pot of coffee on? Oh, well, yeah, I believe I got one here. So that meant I was supposed to go next door to the motel where I stay and buy him a dozen donuts and go out there and sit and pick with him, you know. So I got out there, and when I pulled up in his driveway, I hadn't no more gotten gotten out of my car when I heard the screen door slap on the back of his cabin. And here he comes out, and he meets me in the gate with that mandolin up in the air just playing his tune. Here's a little tune I've been working on this morning. What do you think about this one? And it just dawned on me here the night before, I was playing with guys that the oldest one was 10 years his junior. And they were trying to recreate stuff that they had done in the 40s and 50s, and they're just jamming around playing with it. And here was, like I said, an old man, 80-some years old at that point. here's something I'm working on today.
Still creating, still got that driving force.
Yeah. And I wrote this song not too long ago called Dream. I've got a fella in the Americana music world trying to coach me on how to get the record played out there. But the song, would you be one to dance among the stars? Would you hold the string that flies the moon? Would you dare to dream when hope's not about? It's all on you, all you. You can fly, you can fly, you can fly, you can soar on high, far out over the clouds, casting your eyes across fleecy skies. Your feet never need leave the ground. Weave your dreams, make them real, your illusion revealed. Stand you bold in the midday sun, when no shadows cast before your past, the blessing you are, you've become. Now dream. And that whole thing about stand you bold in the midday sun, when no shadows cast, those shadows behind you, how many people do you know that are caught up in something that happened yesterday that they can't escape from?
Exactly.
How many people do you know that are saying, man, if Santa Claus just comes and brings me what I need this year, then my whole world's going to be all right? How many people do you know that will engage you right in the middle of this moment? That was what came from Monroe, about how to engage life in this moment without the shackles of yesterday or tomorrow dragging you.
Oh my God, that's beautiful. You know, the way that you said those lyrics, you could just do the spoken word of that thing. That was beautiful. You should go down to a poetry slam down Nashville if they have one.
Well, you know, anything I know about the creative world that I'm in, and I had friends who just tried to write and write. They didn't, you know, Leon Russell was one. He turned out being a good friend to me through my career. And he was constantly trying to write standards, you know, like This Masquerade or A Song for You or some of those things. He was constantly trying to do that. With me, the songs and the music come through. I'm not trying to do it. I mean, I've tried to run from this banjo ever since 1983. I quit for nearly 10 years. Kerry Hayes, the one who got me back into playing. And on those first records, we had Sammy Sheeler hired to come in and do those. And Sammy wound up with a job which took him to Europe, and I couldn't find a local banjo player up here. I just had to get down my metronome and relearn how to play again. But it's something, when that stuff comes to me, it's just, I have no concept where it comes from, but the lyrics like that, the thoughts like that, the tunes that I've written, be it 40 years late or any of the tunes that I've ever written, I can't really explain how those come through me. I know it's nothing that I'm able to physically contrive on my own or, you know, just saying, oh, I'm going to write a tune now. It don't happen like that for me. It just doesn't.
Wow, amazing. Well, let's do another song here.
All right, well, when Bill Keith came into the band, you know, he changed the music a lot, but he also changed fiddler's conventions for banjo players. All of a sudden, he only recorded five tunes. He recorded Sailor's Hornpipe, Devil's Dream, Shenandoah Breakdown, Salt Creek, and Santa Claus were the five tunes that he did. But that was the explosion right there that ushered in this elevated art form that bluegrass became in that world. So I'm going to play one of the tunes that they did on those sessions. And this became one of the first ones that started being played around Galax and Union Grove and everything, because it was one of the easier ones. I understand when they went into the studio, Doug Hutchins, I think, was telling me that they called up Rudy Lyle and got Rudy to play it. It's something Monroe had written in the 50s while Rudy was in the band. So he plays the tune over the phone for them, and this is what they went in the studio and worked out right here. And I hope I can do it this morning.